The Guardian.
Roy Grace sat in the dark, in his aging Alfa Romeo, in the line of stationary traffic, rain drumming the roof, his fingers drumming the wheel, barely listening to the Dido CD that was playing.
Out on the beach now, she keeps watch, but there is no sign of a sail. She is a huddle on the shore, like some fluff-feathered bird, hunkered into the puff of itself, only her white face protruding from the mass of garments. I can see almost nothing of her balled up there, not a jut of a joint or a wisp of silver.
The fire managed in what was a really terrifying entrance to free its very own flames, its tongues in staccato intervals, serpentine and red, which appeared and disappeared, along with black tortiglione of smoke, black and greasy like some over-barbecued bosam.
Good prose, like good health, is easy to take for granted. Our pleasure in reading depends on it, but putting your finger on exactly what it is about a sentence, a paragraph, or indeed a novel that gives it a good prose style is something of a challenge. It's a challenge we've been putting to writers appearing here at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, including Adam Thirlwell, Neil Gaiman and Peter James. But we'll start with the writer who set us wondering about literary style in the first place, Ian McEwan. He was speaking at the Guardian Book Club back in London when John Mullen asked him what he aims for when he's writing prose.
It has to be something to do with what I like in reading as well as what I like in writing. In other words, I love writing that makes me see the scene with clarity, and I love precision. One of the writers I admire a great deal is Conrad, and Conrad, as you know, wrote that famous preface to The Nigger of Narcissus, that his task was to make you see. And that requires you to find, since you can't describe everything in a room, in a hotel room, is to find the detail. And hone in on it and hope that it carries also some little penumbra of emotional weight that will serve your purpose. But then in other cases, you know, I would want readers to think that, you know, the whole stretches of, I don't know, any book, Atonement, for example, that have none of that detachment, and that the prose pursues the idea that words, sentences, should be like glass, that you see straight through them. You don't even notice the sentence. You see the thing that the sentence refers to, which is another kind of state of grace, I think. Glass prose. These are the two elements that I think one moves backwards and forwards between. But detail noticing, what Nabokov called fondling the details in a lecture he gave to Cornell students. All readers, he was talking to English 101 students. But I take his advice to heart as a writer as well as a reader. Forget the moonshine of generalizations. You know nothing about literature, he says to these young students. Do not talk to me of themes. I don't want to hear you talk about themes. You're not grown up enough to talk about themes. Your business is to fondle the details as a reader. And I take that advice to heart. But I fondle them warmly.
McEwan's aspiration for clarity echoes down the centuries. George Orwell put it in almost the same words when he said, "Good prose is like a window pane." And much the same spirit infuses Ezra Pound's recommendation to use no superfluous word, no adjective which does not reveal something, or Schopenhauer's declaration that every really great writer tries to express his thoughts as purely, clearly, definitely, and shortly as possible. Back in the first century AD, Quintilian suggested that clarity was the first virtue of composition, while Aristotle argued that for style to be good, it must be clear in the fourth century BC. When Neil Gaiman says he aspires to an invisible prose which doesn't get in the way of the story, he's following in a tradition which stretches back to the dawn of Western civilization. But sitting here in the 21st century, Gaiman is all too aware this ideal is impossible to achieve.
As an author, when people start talking to me about style and prose style, what I immediately think of is the stuff that you actually can't help doing. It's not even the stuff that you put on like a fancy suit of clothes. It's how you walk and how you move when you're naked. one of my favorite writers who is forgotten was a writer named John Collier, who was a very, very good short story writer. He wound up making most of his money from Hollywood, where he did things like write the script for The African Queen. His prose style was whatever was needed to make the story work.
He kind of chameleon.
Absolutely chameleon. And you go from story to story, and he would just find the right voice, whether it was first person or third person. The way that he used words seemed completely different from story to story.
And is that what you aspire to when you're writing yourself?
I aspire to an invisibility of prose that I know I will never attain. When I started out as a writer, I loved people who were absolutely there and swaggering front and center. Writers like R.A. Lafferty from Tulsa, a science fiction writer. You can call him science fiction writer because I don't know what else to call him. But he had this glorious, rollicking style. You could genuinely tell a Lafferty story within a sentence. Nobody else wrote like that. Weird, high rhetoric, a use of high language and low language within the same sentence, odd questions, and an authorial voice. It had to be Lafferty. I loved Chesterton for very similar reasons. You knew you were in a Chesterton story.
Straight away.
Absolutely. I remember the first author where I remember going, this is somebody writing who isn't writing like anybody else, was C.S. Lewis. And I would have been about 7 years old. And it was the way that he deployed brackets. Suddenly you'd get an authorial comment directly to you in brackets. And I went, somebody's writing this. They're not writing like anything else. And the fact that, you know, C.S. Lewis was somebody who knew his way around an English sentence, who could write beautifully, crisply. I'm painfully aware that if I am writing beautifully, if you're ever reading anything of mine and you go, my God, that's a beautiful sentence, how beautifully constructed that is, it probably means I was in trouble. And I'm doing the equivalent of waving a hand over here to distract you from the fact that something structurally is just a little bit wrong, or I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, so I'm going to write something beautiful and make everybody go, ah, because I would much rather be invisible.
And the idea is that the invisible prose doesn't get in the way of the story.
Absolutely. I love clean prose.
But if the job of the author is to make stuff up, to make things new, is there an obligation on the author to make the words new, to make the prose new, to say it in a way that hasn't been said before?
Yes, absolutely. And I think laziness in writing, saying things that people have said before you in the way that they've said them, is a bad thing, is a terrible thing. There is an absolute joy to watching people hone and build their own way of writing. You know, you look at Raymond Chandler discovering ways of using hard-boiled detective fiction and ways of, you know, deploying his metaphors. Something suddenly looks like a tarantula on a slice, as out of place as a tarantula on a slice of devil's food cake or whatever. You go, what a great metaphor. That's marvelous. It's when people read him and then just do that. And you're going, well, there's nothing new here. Or you know, reading third-rate copies of Douglas Adams. Nobody wants to read a third-rate copy of Douglas Adams. They want to read Douglas Adams or not read Douglas Adams. So you are so much better off developing your own prose style. Having said that, I started off writing like lots of other people. That was how I, as a writer, began. I didn't have a voice, but I could do voices like an impressionist, and I had story ideas. So I would take a voice and find a way of telling it using what I'd learned by copying other people. Somewhere in there, you know, a million words later, I looked up and I obviously had a style. And I obviously had a style which was identifiable as me, because it's the stuff you do wrong.
Like Ian McEwan, the crime novelist Peter James says he always tries to write the kind of novel he'd like to read. Though for James, the challenge is to find prose which will keep the reader turning the page.
One thing that I learned very early on is how important it is to include all the senses to make the reading experience really complete. You know, I like, you know, what does something look like? But what does it smell like? What does it feel like if you touch it? Even what does it sound like? And sometimes what does it taste like? smell is something I think we underestimate hugely in how we see the world.
Mm. But I'm wondering if that objective, to be as clear as you can, to kind of describe what's going on so that the reader gets it straight away, if that's quite enough for a novelist, because you need to also get something of the feeling of what's going on.
I think emotion is, there's almost inseparable trinity for me of kind of emotion, action, plot, and also something that's incredibly important is research. And I think you know, characters, plot, research are inseparable, because I do a huge amount. I go out with the police pretty well every week, mostly in Sussex, but also up in the Met in London and in many other forces around the world, because they have their own language, they have their own way of looking at the world. And a huge number of my characters are police officers, and if I tried to make it up, I'd never get the authenticity.
And it's important to you to have the right argo, the right...
Yeah, and the acronyms, you know, they're changing all the time as well. And just, you know, that kind of slightly gallowsy humour that they have. You know, the police do perceive things differently because they see more than you and I or anybody else sees in our lifetimes. They'll see that in a week.
You know, in terms of the terrible things that they're...
Yeah, they'll go to a terrible car accident or they'll go to a terrible homicide scene or a horrible domestic abuse fight. You know, I think a lot of them try not to be cynical, but they develop a kind of hardness and a resilience to it. They'd go mad if they didn't.
And is this kind of hardness, this directness, is that something that you try and achieve with your prose?
Very much so. You know, I try, when I'm describing a police officer, to describe in the way that police think. You know, if you talk to any police officer and you say, you know, what has your view of human nature changed from the time you were a kid to after 10, 15 years in the force, they will all of them say, yeah. And the principal one is that most police officers don't trust people. You know, they've lost that kind of ability to trust, and seeing that everyone is like a potential villain until proved otherwise. Not in terms of brutality, but in terms of just, you know, being objective, you know, looking at a scene in a different way. I go into a bar or restaurant with a police officer, he'll stop on the threshold. He'll look at every face in the room before he steps over. Two reasons. One is he doesn't want to walk into a place that's about to kick off. Second is he doesn't want to sit down and have lunch two tables away from a villain he's been looking for 4 years and didn't spot. and also, I always know if I'm going to meet a police officer in a restaurant or a cafe, pub, I know where he'll be sitting. Actually, he'll be sitting in a corner, back to the wall, preferably two walls, with a view of the whole restaurant and the door. And they actually call it the policeman's chair.
And so that's the kind of perspective that you're kind of adopting all the time. I'm wondering, you say that policemen, their view of the world has changed. Has your writing, has your prose changed over the last, you know, how long you've been writing Roy Grace now?
I've been writing Roy Grace. The first Roy Grace, which was Dead Simple, came out in 1984.
Yeah, there you go.
Kind of about just action for a second. I mean, I tend to write, when I get into action, I like very often very short sentences, you know, direct, direct, direct. I find that kind of, it's like the length of my sentences often decreases with the speed of the action.
So, I mean, the cuts are faster, as it were.
Yeah, and I'm very conscious of that. I'll think a scene through and I'll think, you know, how does that feel actually living that scene? If you're in the heat of a moment chase, which I've been in many times in the police, things do happen in a very staccato way. You know, you're doing a raid, you know, you arrive outside the building, they put the door in, you know, they're yelling, police, smash the door in, because they've got 30 seconds before that drug dealer will have flushed all the drugs down the toilet. So everything is happening at a kind of heightened tension, heightened speed, and in really short bursts, you know, smash the door down, go in, dogs in, grab someone.
If the rat-a-tat rhythm of a police raid exists at one end of the literary spectrum, the novelist Amy Sackville's meditations on the ebb and flow of human relationships are perhaps to be found right at the other end. For Sackville, the jostle and hum of the words on the page is very much part of the reading experience.
I think precision is important, and yes, clarity as against abstraction or vagueness. But I suppose what interests me as a reader and as a writer is the way that words relate to the world and how we try to represent the world in language and how language constitutes the world. And so for me, the words themselves are of interest, I suppose.
You kind of relish the experience of encountering the words on the page, yeah, as part of the experience of reading.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and that needn't be fussy. In fact, it shouldn't be fussy, but there's a kind of ludic quality to that as well, which I enjoy. I enjoy somebody kind of pulling language apart and seeing what they can do with it.
Because literature, if you're writing a novel, the novel is supposed to be something new at some level, isn't it? Mm. So do you think that remaking of the language, word by word, sentence by sentence, is kind of part of the job?
Yeah, I think finding a different way to express the world, finding a way to draw closer to it or to ask different questions of it or to ask the same questions in a different way that makes us rethink them is the job of the novel.
Remaking the world through language, rendering experience in a particular style may well be part of the novelist's job, as Sackville suggests. But what does this mean for the translator? For the writer Adam Thirlwell, the brute fact of translation presents a radical challenge to the idea of literary style tout court, a challenge he's examined through a game of Chinese whispers in multiples.
Of course, if you love novels, of course you're going to read Tolstoy's War and Peace in English. You're not going to not read it because you can't read the Russian. And yet, at the same time, there's this kind of bit of us, I think, that believes that certainly one of the things one loves most about writing is a writer's style, is the kind of what they do to language. And then there's this kind of problem there that you think, well, literally none of the words you've ever read by Tolstoy are the ones he wrote. And in one sense, that seems like the most obvious truism. And then it seems like all of these truisms, sometimes something concealing something much larger, it seemed to me. So that was what I was feeling. That was therefore that somehow I needed to believe that style could translate. That was the kind of optimistic wager of the book.
Well, talk us through a little bit what this experiment consists of. How'd you go about addressing that question?
I think calling it experiment is... That was our mock scientific word for this. I'm not sure any proper scientist would acknowledge this as a serious experiment. So what we did was, I did it with McSweeney's magazine, and we chose, I think, 11 or 12 original stories. And the idea there was that they would either be relatively unknown or untranslated, if possible, stories by famous writers like Kafka, or new fiction that hadn't been translated before by novelists who, while I think fantastic, maybe haven't quite got the huge readership they deserve, like Enrique Villamatas or Laszlo Krasznahorkai. Then what we did was, I suppose it was a system of Chinese whispers, that in general, each story got translated about 5 times. And the basic joke was that only the first translator in the series was actually translating the original. And so each subsequent translator was only translating the version they were given, the translation or the translation of a translation or of a translation of a translation of a translation.
So that it would gradually mutate.
So it would gradually mutate. And the kind of thing to see was how far the story would change when 5 novelists, each with their own often very different styles and ways of writing and theories of translation and experiences of translation, would do and what would happen to it, whether it would remain interestingly basically the same thing at the end of the sequence or horribly savagely maimed and mutilated.
Because you actually gave them an instruction to try and preserve the style, didn't you?
Yeah, the instruction was, I deliberately kept myself out of it as much as possible. I was just the sort of spreadsheet manager. That the only instructions they were given were, give me the story back again in such a way that you think you've reproduced the story. I'm not sure that was exact word for word, but that was the basic thing, that therefore what I wanted was them to sort of not just worry about the literal meaning of each sentence, but think, how do I recreate this so that, as it were, I would be happy publishing this thing as my own work, almost. It massively varied. So some people very much wanted to stay incredibly closely, and that often, interestingly, I'd say the ones who had translated most tended to the more faithful, which I wasn't expecting. I think I was more expecting the opposite. Or people who'd never translated at all, they were also very faithful. It was the people in the middle who'd done a couple who felt, I think, more liberty. And it also depended on who they were translating. That Kafka, for instance, was so evidently and rightly revered that it was interesting that no one really wanted to take liberties with the Kafka. And it was only, I think, and Dave Eggers did the last story in that sequence, and it's only really his story that I think truly departs from,
it really moves it on, yeah,
the Kafka, because I think everyone else was evidently slightly worried about.
So what were the results in the end?
In one sense, the initial premise, or the thing I thought I was testing, I think kind of got proved, which is enough of the stories, the style somehow does change, it does stay the same, even when often quite major semantic errors have been made. I was quite interested that you could make quite a lot of kind of errors and still the style had kind of
staircases preserved. Could become steps and,
exactly, yeah. Or in one case attics could become grape arbors with apparently no problem for the story. But I think I started this as certainly someone, not a kind of ardent formalist, but certainly someone for whom style was a hugely important aspect of what I, how I read and how I kind of came into writing. And I'm kind of now just thinking, well, maybe this thing just doesn't exist, or certainly doesn't exist in the way I thought it did. And certainly the idea of a sort of one person, one style mentality, that I'm now wondering. One of the things that I loved was kind of watching the same style sort of migrate through five novelists, so that somehow you had to believe that maybe you could imagine one novelist doing all five versions or five novelists doing one. And kind of, it was this idea that why was it that we felt so interested in developing your own style or kind of thinking, oh, well, that's how I write. And so it was a real initial challenge to sort of just feel like I could write like this. And then as soon as suddenly you get into it, you think, well, this is actually, there's a weirdness of, as a novelist, you're used to trying to mimic things in the outside world, as it were. You're trying to constantly find linguistic recreations of non-linguistic things. And then suddenly you think, well, maybe actually a style is something you can mimic just as much, that a style is an object out there in the world. So it's definitely changed my kind of, my ideas of property and style, I think, totally.
So I guess, what do you now aim for when you're writing something of your own?
Well, I think now it's interesting. I'm finding it quite hard to finish the novel. I was writing a novel and kind of slightly had to put it aside as this project kind of engorged itself more than I was expecting. And I think one of the reasons I'm now slightly kind of, I don't know, just slightly in some doubt, is trying to work out now what I want to do with the style, as it were, that I'm no longer quite so happy to just write a sentence I know I can write or a paragraph form that I know I can do. So,
and that's because you've kind of seen all these different registers.
Yeah, suddenly I'm thinking, well, maybe actually far more is possible, or certainly far, and also, weirdly, I think, kind of getting really into old-fashioned ideas of truth and soul and essence and these things that I feel like I was schooled kind of to never care about. Suddenly, that seems much more important than some kind of elegance of style or formal trick.
Perhaps good prose is simply as various as it needs to be. Our thanks to our varied authors, Adam Thirlwell, whose Multiples is published by Portobello, Amy Sackville, Peter James, Neil Gaiman and Ian McEwan. Tomorrow we'll be back with more from the Edinburgh International Books Festival. You can listen online, follow us on SoundCloud or subscribe via iTunes if you search for Guardian Books Podcast. Until then, from me, Richard Lee, thanks for listening. For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.